Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I am Michael Savage. I'm giving you one man's opinion. This default thing is nonsense, because if you want my opinion, I would say default. Who's going to really be hurt by the defaulting? Companies like General Electric would be hurt by the default, by the way, not us. Do you realize that if you look back on the history of loans from the IMF and defaults, you look back to the 60s. I've been around. I've seen it all happen. Remember when South American countries used to default on debt and we would rewrite the loan? It's like you. Like if you get into trouble and you go to a bank and you say, I can't pay my bills. In the old days of 20 years ago, in many cases, the banks would restructure your loan, which means they would forgive a certain percentage of it and let you keep your house and your car and some basics so that you could climb back out of debt. But they certainly didn't put you in the poorhouse because they knew they would lose a customer. What do you think China would do if we defaulted on our debt? What do I care if our bond ratings go down? What does that matter to me? Does that affect you? How does it affect you? You're earning zero interest on your investment anyway. So therefore, who's going to be hurt by a default? Nobody but China. And a few American zillionaires who are benefiting from these from this artificial economy that's being controlled by them anyway. New York City, WOR. Betty, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that you were saying who is going to benefit from raising the debt ceiling? The same people that pulled the wool over our eyes back in 2008 that said the world was going to fall apart if we didn't give out $700 billion or trillion dollars. It's all the
that's
people
right.
on Wall Street. All the people on Wall Street all over the world investing.
And don't forget the construction projects that are going on around America are benefiting very few people. These large construction, these make-work projects are benefiting people to the trillions. But let me ask you something. Do you agree with me that defaulting on the debt would not be catastrophic to the American people? It would be catastrophic for who? The Chinese and who? Some American corporations who hold the bonds.
Money is fiction at this point. I mean, what is money? Our dollar, what is it based on? It's based on nothing. I don't know.
I'm telling you, I would say default on the debt. I think we should copy Argentina and Venezuela from the 60s. What's the difference? I mean, they did it. They're doing better than we are. The only people who get screwed would be the Chinese. They're the ones who screwed us anyway with artificial control of the currency. And would not because they own the Congress. They didn't impose tariffs. I would have imposed a 20% tariff on Chinese goods 3 years ago when I saw what they were doing to us. So since they rigged the game by buying the politicians who should have imposed tariffs on them, I would say take it back by defaulting on the debt. What's the difference? Okay, moving on. So last night, I'm in bed again watching too much television. I'm starting to get embarrassed now. The weather's bad, so I have an excuse to stay home and watch television, and I do it, and I shouldn't. Because when the children were young, we didn't have a television. I refused to let them watch TV. I was one of those. And they both turned out great. Maybe it helped. But now I find myself watching television at night, and too much of it, mainly movies. In fact, either the History Channel, Military History, the Science Channel, National Geographic, or a movie. So late at night, I'm watching a movie from 1948. That had me captivated for a number of reasons. I don't know the name of it, but it was about an FBI agent who goes undercover into the underworld, pretends to be a criminal, and it was so unbelievably bad that I couldn't stop watching it. You know, and now we walk down the halls of the FBI where J. Edgar Hoover. Remember those movies? The guys all had those Dick Tracy suits. So I'm watching the movie, and I start to see certain things in it. A lot of the characters were from real life. When they went into a gym in Philadelphia where the scenes were shot, they were real boxers training in a gym, which was very interesting to watch. The characters. Where are the men like that? I ask myself, what happened to men that they've all become almost homogenized in this country? When I was a young boy, the men were all like weird looking. Guys had like nasal hair, ear hair. But aside from that, I'm doing that to attract your eyes and ears to what I'm saying to you. The men look different. Now everyone has a homogenized, pasteurized, aluminumized look. I don't understand what happened to my country. Men were very unique. I'm saying, you take a gym full of white men, they all look different. They had weird faces. Now everyone has the same kind of like idiotic grin. But anyway, so the movie's about an FBI agent who goes undercover and gets into the rackets, whatever, in order to bust him. So, you know, I just saw the movie with Jack Nicholson. What is it called? The Untouchables. I forget. The Untouched. I don't even remember the movie's name. They will help me out. The Departed. And it was excellent. I really liked Nicholson. I liked DiCaprio. I liked Matt Damon. They were all good in the movie, and the movie was very captivating. But a good portion of the plot was taken directly from this 1948 slap them together and, you know, throw it out there movie. Now, that's not why I'm talking about it. In the movie, there's a quick scene about them wanting a fighter who looks like he's going to be the favorite to take a fall for money. You know, take a dive, in other words. In other words, he's the favorite, and they say to him, if you go down in the third round, we'll make a lot of money because you're the favorite. And in all those movies from the 45 era up until about when the hippie scum took over the movie business, after the hippie communist scum from New York City took over the movie business, most of the movies were about temptations and honor. A fighter was set, it was said, you take a dive and you'll make a lot of money, and it was the tension of the fighter saying, no, I have honor. I will not take a dive. And what usually happened to him is he got beaten up or killed. Or you go back to On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, that great movie. What was that all about? That was about honor. He was unwilling to take a dive, in other words, and he died for it. So the movies were always about the temptations and the honor of the man who would not accept the temptation for money, for the quick buck. That's what the tension was. That's what the storyline was. That's what America grew up on. That's what America became strong on. Now you got Murdoch, who's into the quick buck, and so he'll take the temptation for a higher rating and a quicker buck. No honor. Do you understand what I'm saying to you or not? How a society can be formed by its art, and you can't condemn every movie ever made. That would be absurd. Some are good, some are bad, some are indifferent. Some are funny, some are not funny, blah, blah, blah. But what I'm getting at is there were movies about morality in the days that I grew up. For example, crime never paid. You never could see the bad guy win in a movie when I grew up. My father taught me that. He said, you notice, Michael, every movie the bad guy gets caught in the end. Now we know that's nonsense. All you got to do is look at the U.S. Senate. We understand that. But in those days, you were conditioned by your movie to realize you'd get caught in the end. So I asked my father, why is it? He said, well, the FBI worked out something with Hollywood where Hollywood agreed never to show the bad guy winning because they didn't want to encourage people to go into that line of work. Now, compare that to the movies being produced now by the hippie pothead scum from hell in the movie business today, where the bad guy is always shown to win and the straight guy is shown to be a moron. Now, what you have today are people who are bums, who have no class, who think they're somebody. You get the picture? Do you understand how hard the job is that I do? To try to put everything into context, it's almost impossible. When you have such power that they can turn upside down, straight up, and you don't even know which way is up anymore, and you don't know what honor is anymore.
Savage.
We've got an out-of-control Marxist president using classic Frankfurt School Marxist tactics, which I actually described in great detail in Trickle Up Poverty. You'll have to research that one. Go to Trickle Up Poverty and look up the Frankfurt School. They're using the tricks of the Frankfurt School, which goes back to the 1920s. The Frankfurt School of Politics, which was developed by communists in Europe, Frankfurt, Germany, to be specific, says that you never offer a plan of your own. You only attack the enemy. You constantly put them down and attack them. But you never offer a plan of your own. Now, if that doesn't describe the tactics of Obama, I'd like to know what does. If you think this is coming out of a vacuum, you're mistaken, because I am a student of fascism. I'm a student of Marxism. Obama, by every definition, he doesn't have to wear a red beret and wave a red flag. He's a Marxist. His policies are Marxist. His behavior is that of a Marxist. So his activities and those surrounding him are those of Marxists. Is that of the Frankfurt School, which is attack, 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 and constantly attack the enemy, never agree with anything they do. That's what the Democrats are doing. And the Republicans, as modest as they are, as moderate, fiscally conservative as they are the only hope we have. They're trying to not raise taxes, and they're trying to cut down on the so-called entitlements, which are nothing but bloated bureaucracies that are rife with corruption. Many foreign groups have come into this country and sucked our system dry. They've robbed us blind with our Medicare and our stupidity like you cannot believe. We're like a big, fat, sitting elephant being eaten alive by pygmies who have brought us down by sticking a spear into our you-know-what. And our elephant is now on the ground, and the pygmies are sucking the fat out of the guts of the elephant of the United States of America. And so those who represent us even modestly, the Republicans are saying, hey, look, maybe the elephant can get off the ground if we take the spears out of its you-know-what and suture up the wound and stop cutting the fat out of it. You know, let the animal restore itself to health. Stop with the entitlements. You know, and I both know these so-called sacred cows, Medicare, Medicaid, and all. You know how corrupt they are. You know that many people who collect those checks never earned them. The SDSI checks, for example, known as crazy checks in San Francisco, are collected by failed writers who sit around in cafes stoned out of their minds all day long, who smoke marijuana and collect crazy checks coming out of the Social Security Fund. And they boast about it, SDSI. And they work sometimes small jobs without paying any taxes, such as selling marijuana or things of that nature. I'm giving you one example. Or those who provide various and sundry services for Medicare, which you well know are beyond comprehension and costs. An aspirin for $32, an ambulance ride for $10,000. You have no idea how bad it is. And the government does know how bad it is. So the Republicans say, cut a certain percentage out of Medicare, Medicaid, whatever. Cut down on these stupid entitlements. Raise the retirement age by 2 years. And the Democrats are saying, no, we don't have a plan. We don't want a plan. Whatever you say is no good. And so that's why we're in this situation. But moving on. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number, michaelsavage.com. We're also talking about, on the greatest talk show in the history of America, the American Taliban, who I affectionately call Rat Boy, John Walker Lind, whose father wrote an editorial in the New York Times saying that now that Osama bin Laden's dead, it's time for them to release Rat Boy. I say, yeah, sure, President Obama, release Rat Boy, and he can come home the day you know who comes home, right? Yeah, you can release him. Absolutely, it's time to release him. He can come home when Mr. Spann, when John Michael Spann comes home. When Johnny comes marching home again, Rat Boy can come home again, as far as I'm concerned. I want to play for you a little history here. I'm going to play three clips of American Taliban John Walker Lind's parents going back to 2007. First, Mama Taliban, Marilyn Walker.
Given the temperature in the country at the time after 9/11, I could understand it. People were angry. They were confused. There was a lot of pain.
Here's the guy to blame.
Let's blame him. I mean, it's not rational. I don't think it was a rational thing, but, you know.
Let's stop right there. Now, here's the mother who left her husband, converted to Buddhism, and I don't have to tell you what an American is who becomes a Buddhist. Americans are to Buddhism, I'll finish the analogy another time. They think that by putting their hands together and sitting in a mat, on a mat, they become a Buddhist. Ask a real Buddhist what they think of Americans mocking Buddhism, and you'll understand what I think about most of these frauds. But she says, you're stupid. You were angry. You were confused by 9/11. You really didn't know who did it. You were full of pain. It was irrational to blame her poor son. Although he converted to Islam, he took terrorist training, he was found in a firefight with an AK-47 hiding like a rat in the bottom of a basement. You were confused, and it's irrational to blame him because he wasn't a real traitor. Now listen to what the rest of the clip has. You won't believe this gold that we found.
Didn't have anywhere else to put it.
But it was like a nightmare for us as a family, because we know John. We know he's not
anti-American. We know he doesn't have any sympathy for terrorism. And yet here he stood accused of these things in the public eye, in the media.
Hold on, let's stop for a minute. You know, Mr. Lind, you can't mean what you just said. He doesn't support terrorism. And yet he's accused of these things. Well, let me remind you of something, Mr. and Mrs. Lind, about your wonderful son who grew up in Marin County, whose brain was poisoned by the liberalism of the schools out here. Your rat son attended a training camp for military training. Your rat son traveled to the Al-Farouq training camp, a facility associated with Osama bin Laden. Your rat son in June of July of 01 remained at the Al-Farouq camp and participated fully in its training activities, including courses in weapons, orienteering, navigation, explosives, and battlefield combat. These facts that I'm reading you come directly by Lind and his attorney that he signed on his sentencing. He said, having sworn allegiance to jihad in or about July or August 01 after completing his training, the defendant traveled to Kabul, Afghanistan to assist the Taliban. In or about July or August 2001, the defendant carried an AKM rifle issued by the Taliban while he traveled together with approximately 150 non-Afghan fighters from Kabul to the front line in Takhir in northeastern Afghanistan. Between about September and November 2001, John Walker Lind Ratboy, his defendant's fighting group, was divided into smaller groups and rotated in 1 to 2 week shifts in the Takhar trenches opposing Northern Alliance troops. In other words, Ratboy admitted to having trained in a camp run by Osama bin Laden. The son also admitted he carried an AKM rifle and grenades. And yet in 2002, his demented father compared his son to Nelson Mandela, which just shows you how little the lawyer's words can be trusted. While Frank Lind writes that his son is intelligent, spiritual, good-natured, he expects you to believe his son was so clueless that he did not really understand that he was training under and fighting for the man who ordered the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And apparently, the Lind people apparently think that John Walker Lind had no responsibility in warning U.S. forces about the prison attack that led to the death of CIA operative Johnny Mike Spann. Spann's father disgraces the name Truth.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Debt ceiling talks, more and more and more, more in circles and more attacks. The August 2nd deadline is drawing closer and closer. Now a proposal is being offered by the so-called Gang of Six. Well, who are the Gang of Six? What does it matter? Former Chief of Staff to Vice President Dick Cheney, David Addington, is here to talk with us about it. You see, he's a domestic and economic policy advisor for the Heritage Foundation. David Addington, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you very much.
Well, briefly, what are all the plans out there that are supposed to address our debt and deficit crisis?
Well, I can go through every one of them, but let me make it short for you. Not a single one has been offered that gets the job done. And the job is clear. The job is to drive down federal spending and borrowing and balance the budget, while preserving our ability to protect America and without raising taxes. We've had one good proposal from the House of Representatives. We've had four bad proposals from the Senate. The good House proposal, cut cap and balance, passed the House with 234 votes, and the Senate then voted not to even take it up. And that's where we stand today.
So what do these plans have in common?
The four bad Senate plans all have in common raising your taxes. The decent plan that passed the House, while it's not perfect, it was a good step in the right direction, has all the right kinds of elements. It cuts discretionary spending, including also cutting inappropriate ways with policy changes, the entitlement programs that are the big programs that have been driving up the cost and driving up America's debt. Then, in addition to the current cuts, they also put a cap on spending over the next 10 years to bring down the proportion of our economy that's taken up and spent by the federal government. And then the third element of the House bill was to pass the balanced budget amendment. In contrast, the Senate proposals have all been either simply let the president borrow more money and do nothing on cutting, or in some cases they do some cutting, but also do hiking of taxes, which, A, the American people don't want hikes in their taxes, and B, as we know from American history, it is a terrible thing to do to cut, to raise taxes in a recession.
Well, why is it so hard to reach agreement on one plan?
The president wants to raise taxes. It's that short and that simple. The problem is not a lack of revenue from taxing yet higher the taxes of American people. Instead, we need to be cutting spending. And the president keeps insisting on taxes to the point where he's now willing to risk the creditworthiness, the full faith and credit of the United States, because he wants to hike taxes.
Is the Gang of Six deal our last shot at a bipartisan solution? Did it improve the situation or make it worse?
Yeah, the Gang of Six plan was a non-starter because it raises taxes. We were disappointed, frankly, with what we found out they're doing for the latest proposal from Speaker Boehner, because it basically fails to meet the objective of driving down spending and borrowing without raising taxes, because the latest plan would be a two-step process under which the president would for sure get to borrow another $1 trillion in two parts, a $325 billion part that he'd get right away and $675 that he'd get later by just asking for it because Congress will never override it. But what do the people get in that deal? They only get $1.2 billion in discretionary cuts over 10 years. That may sound like real cuts, but it isn't. It's backloaded, so very few of the cuts occur early on. And they don't include any changes to reduce the cost of entitlement programs. So you're not making any progress long-term on driving down the debt. Then as the second step, they say, well, we're going to create a joint select committee of Congress, and it's going to solve our problem that we haven't been able to solve the last 40 years by recommending $1.6 trillion reduction in our debt by November 23rd, and then we'll have Congress vote on it. But that plan says that the committee is going to have a combination of tax hikes and spending cuts to get the debt down. And again, we don't need tax hikes. What we need is strong spending cuts. So we're not making progress. And basically, President Obama, who's put nothing on the table, meanwhile, Boehner in the House, Republicans, have now started negotiating with themselves, and they're offering something that goes further towards the Obama-Reid, let's tax everybody proposal.
Well, what role do you think tax reform should play in the situation?
Well, tax reform is a good thing, but let me emphasize, it's important what you mean by tax reform. It should be revenue neutral. It shouldn't increase anybody's taxes. But there are a lot of good changes that you can make in the U.S. tax code if you make them all at once, to broaden the base of who's paying taxes, but at the same time drop the rates that people are paying. And as a result, you can get a very good pro-growth tax policy to generate economic activity, which generates jobs. And so tax reform would be an excellent part of this now. The problem is nobody's proposals contain true tax reform, revenue-neutral tax reform that's pro-growth to create jobs.
Well, would the Gang of Six plan really reconcile a debt problem or just push more difficult decisions further into the future?
The Gang of Six plan doesn't solve the problem. For starters, it didn't catch fire and hasn't got the votes. But particularly, its problem is it raises a substantial amount of taxes, and it is not clear at all that the American people want any more taxes, and certainly that would face a skeptical House of Representatives at a minimum.
What is the best case scenario in your mind for the August 2nd deadline?
Well, the best case scenario is the president comes to his senses and stops insisting on tax increases. The House and the Senate and the president ought to be able to get together on an intelligent proposal to reduce spending in a way that's consistent with our country's needs and not go and increase taxes in a recession, which is just going to cut investment and cut jobs and put this country deeper into trouble And, of course, if we have less economic action and fewer people with jobs earning a paycheck, you get less revenue into the government, and our problem is that much worse.
David Addington, thanks again for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
So that's that. Talk radio is not only not dead, but talk radio is very much alive. Although the midstream media has been claiming for years now that talk radio is dead, that the empty skirts who have been saying that this is a medium only for fringe extremists or old men, that talk radio is only for old men, I've proven them all wrong. Mark Masters, Talk Radio Network, and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when, 2000? Now, we all hear that the Internet is the king, and a lot of people ran to the Internet with their advertising money. Yet everyone knows that no one's been able to monetize their investment in the Internet. Nobody. You see, talk radio is a medium that you can't hide yourself easily in. You can't hide behind a mustache and such. 3 hours a day, Jerry. 3 hours a day, Jerry. Mr. Mustache on Fox. And unless you have a massive production staff who is talking for you, you're not going to get very far, right? But I don't have a massive staff. I have a very small and very good staff. And when you do talk radio right, people get to know you, people get to understand that you're a real person, and they relate to you. What I'm saying is I've proven that talk radio is a very vibrant medium today. People who listen to talk radio are more acutely aware of what's going on than the average American. Although the fraudulent elites, or shall I say the self-proclaimed drug addicts with microphones and cameras in front of their faces, laugh at you, the average listener to talk radio is far more knowledgeable politically than they would like you to believe. And by the way, listeners to talk radio vote both with their wallets and their ballots.
Savage.
Supporting him now, going to Norway, or to do anything for your son?
No, I'll never have more contact with him in my darkest moments. I think that rather than killing all those people, he should have taken his own life.
This is strong words from a father.
They are, but thinking about what has happened, I get so upset, and I still don't understand that something like this could happen. No normal human being would do something like that.
That's the father of the mass murderer in Norway, who says he wishes that his son had taken his own life instead of doing what he had done. Let's just leave it at that without comment. This is clearly an issue for him to work out, not for me or you to work out. And I don't think I need to go into the fact that Breivik was fascinated with the Crusades and that he imagined himself to be a member of the Knights Templar, a Crusader army of 1,000 years ago. I don't need to repeat that to you. I think if you read anything about that, you can see this. But much can be said about the other side of the aisle, the Muslim extremists, the Muslim murderers, rather, Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri, and many other Islamist murderers. Remember, bin Laden was a businessman and engineer. Zawahiri was a medical doctor in Egypt. Neither were theologians or clergy. And yet they're identified or self-identified as Muslims. Doesn't mean that all Muslims espouse what they espouse. Unfortunately, too many Muslims do. Those who cheered after 9/11 and so on and so forth. I know that many of you don't want to accept that he was in any way a Christian or that any of the Muslims who do not believe in terrorism are not telling you the truth. I know that you actually believe that every Muslim is a terrorist, many of you, and that many of you want to quote the Quran in the areas where the Quran can be quoted rightly as saying that you shall, when you find an infidel, you shall smite him and put a knife to his neck. It's there. It's all in the sutras. It does not mean that all Muslims follow that fundamentalist brand of Islam. Unfortunately, too many of them do. However, if you want to look at the Old Testament, it has very similar edicts, incidentally. Oh, yeah, look at the Old Testament. Now, most Christians don't read the Old Testament nor follow it. They follow the so-called New Testament or the Christian Bible. But you're not going to argue that the poor old Orthodox Jew with the furry hat is walking around wanting to kill people simply because he believes in the Old Testament. They have understood that although it may have been God's word for those times is not necessarily God's words for these times. To me, I can't understand it, frankly. I've given up trying to say what I should follow, what I shouldn't follow. It becomes a point where I don't know what to do personally. I don't want to do launch into me. I mean, if you're going to throw out one of it, then throw it all out. Where do you start? You're going to start judging what God said? I've heard Orthodox rabbis say that to me. Who is it for us to decide what we should follow and which commandments we shouldn't follow? Well, okay, where do you want to go with that one? You're going to stone an adulterer? If you see your father's nakedness, you're supposed to slay the person who uncovers your father's nakedness. Go down and read it. Read Leviticus. It's unbelievably full of murder for moral offenses. I don't believe Orthodox Jews murder adulterers. I don't believe Orthodox Jews murder homosexuals. Do you? So therefore, they're already not following the Old Testament. So therefore, they could also have a shrimp den and enjoy a ham sandwich by that definition. I realize I'm being comedic in a very dangerous political and religious arena, but that's my job, is to be me. That's my job, is to be me. In other words, you're going to either follow it or don't follow it. So what am I arguing? I don't know. What are you arguing? What do you think I'm arguing? I'm not arguing you should not eat shrimp and kill people. I mean, so you say, well, all right, so I'm not going to not kill people, but I'm not going to eat shrimp. Why? Why? I mean, if you're not going to do some of the edicts of the Old Testament, why are you doing any of them? Because you decided what you're going to be God now? You're going to start to decide which commandments you shall follow? How do you interpret this if you're a theologian? See, it's why I am not religious at the end of the day. At the end of the day, I'm not religious. I'm a spiritual person myself. Do I believe in God? Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. You know, I mean, I really, the truth, I'm like Mother Teresa in that regard. I go up and down the whole spectrum. Some days I believe, some weeks I believe, sometimes I believe for years at a time. And then all of a sudden I wake up and I don't believe in anything except in survival. The one credo I personally have found to be the most motivational, operational, and inspirational for me is that of survival. Now, if that's a religion, then I'm a religious man. And that means survive, 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 and don't let anyone stand in your way. Short of killing them. I don't have to kill somebody to get around an obstacle. Okay, I can follow the law pretty good and get what I want. Okay? The trick is to have the guts to follow the law and the guts to use the law and the guts to stick to your guns and not give in. Doesn't mean you have to kill somebody to be tough, and it doesn't mean you have to kill somebody in order to follow your beliefs. But on the other hand, I don't know if that's a religion. To me, I don't know if a religion is of any value unless it teaches you how to survive. See, I felt that for a long time, personally. Again, going back to my own personal belief system. I have to tell you, we are having this discussion. We may never have it again, and we may have it again and again and again. But I'll tell you again. I have been in synagogues. I have been in temples. I've been in churches. And I have never really felt at home in any of those houses of worship. It doesn't mean that they're bad or that they don't serve a useful social purpose. I believe they do. But did they teach the people survival skills? Maybe they do for you. They didn't for me. They did not for me. When I see stories of ancient Buddhist temples that taught their young acolytes the martial arts so that the Buddhist monks with the shaved heads who took vows of this and vows of poverty and vows of that and lived up there in the mountains of China and Tibet could defend themselves against invading armies using hoes and sticks and chairs, I said, now that is a religious teaching I can relate to. Now, I mean, is there a religious teaching to teach you how to kill an enemy with a hoe and a fishing rod and a chair? I don't know. They decided that the young men should not go to the gas chambers like the Jews did in World War II. That I respected. I respected that of the Buddhists who teach their young men to kill the enemy and not sit there with their hands begging them for their lives, but to poke their eye out with anything they have in the room. Because every Jew had done that in the beginning, there wouldn't have been a Holocaust. I've studied it inside and out. I don't care how many times you quote the Bible. What good is it if a man comes to you to kill you and your wife and children? The Bible will not save you. The Bible will not save you. I read this over and over again. I studied the Holocaust from the first day to the last. And let me tell you what I learned. And you go to scholars who studied this. You want to get into this? It's a little tangential here. I read that the Germans were such an orderly society that had the Jews been armed and had the Jews shot the SS, or the Gestapo, rather, in the early days of the roundups and killed them in the hallways of their neat little German apartment buildings, there would have been such a disruption of middle-class German society that the Holocaust would have been derailed, that the German war machine would not have gone after the Jews the way they did. But because the Jews willingly packed their little valises and they said, "Let's go, Martha," and they walked like sheep into the cattle car and then were worked to death or gassed to death, it was done because they had no survival skills. So what good was the religion at that point? What did the religion do for them in the death camps as they watched their daughters being raped by those German bastards? What good did the Bible do them as they watched their children's necks being cut? What, did God come down and save them? No, the Jews who went into the sewers in Poland are the kind of Jews I respected. The Jews who went into the woods in Poland and joined the partisans and cut Nazis' throats and stole their guns and used them in little bands to fight the Nazis. Those are the Jews I respected. Not those who sat there begging for their lives and all they got for it was more slaughter and more humiliation. You know, in the next few days, I'm going to quote from a new book on World War II that just came out. It's unbelievable. A new scholarly work that will make your hair stand up. It will make your hair stand up. It's something that Mel Gibson should be forced to listen to for 24 hours straight with his eyes taped open and his ears taped open and his hands taped to a chair. I'm sorry I got distracted, but you know, you're talking about very volatile issues today. I am anyway. I mean, you're talking about the slaughter of innocent children, albeit they were the children of the Labor Party, the enemies of Norway's cultural identity. I understand that. But they were children. They were teenagers. They were unarmed. Where is the nobility in this man's act? How can anyone sit here and say that was a wonderful, justifiable act? He did a terrible thing, but I can understand it. How can you understand a thing like this? You don't go and kill children because they're the children of Labor Party members. Well, what kind of thinking is this? Then you're the same as the Muslim terrorist who puts a bomb in a pet store in Iraq, as they were doing. Those of you who served in Iraq know that was going on in the beginning.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Obama, as I pointed out, is clearly an extremist, but not a terrorist. Although some would argue that with his war in Libya, he is a terrorist, but that's a separate discussion. He's clearly an extremist. He won't yield to the American people. And when I say the American people, I mean the people who actually earn the money and pay the taxes. I don't mean the American people who are deadbeats and collect checks from the government who don't work. As far as I'm concerned, their opinion doesn't matter. Of course they're going to always vote a raise for themselves. It's the way the world is. People everywhere want something for nothing. But those of us who are paying over 50% of our income with federal, state, and local taxes are fed up. We don't want to pay anymore. And that's where the Tea Party came in. That's where the 70 people who got thrown out of office or the Democrats got fired last November. But the media won't let you remember that. Remember, we had an election after Obama was elected. Remember it? I remember very well because I published Trickle Up Poverty, and it was time to come out at the time of the election. It probably shaped the election to some extent. It sold very well. I mean, it sold almost 200,000-300,000 in hardcover. I realize it's not as good as Harry Potter, but that's a lot of books when you consider a few more than one person reads a book at a time. That's awful. That's an awfully big number. 200,000-300,000 in hardcover. I mean, you take a look at Nancy Pelosi wrote a book that sold 4,000 copies. The politicians on the left publish books. They get $3-4 million advances and no one buys them. You know, I'm controlling my emotions for a number of reasons. The number one being I'm in a state of disbelief that this man Obama is committing such traitorous acts one after the other in plain sight. This communist con man, and there is no outcry in America. Am I the only person in the United States of America who understands that the man has put us at the back of the bus? This communist street organizer, and I see him for what he is. I don't think I'm the only one. I can't be the only one. But then again, I ask myself, am I the only one? Because there should be a huge outcry in America, and I see nothing. Instead, I see the usual. I see the same Hollywood sluts cavorting with their underwear upside down on the streets of Sunset Boulevard, so to speak. I see the same stories about the poor, downtrodden, non-taxpaying welfare mother having a fistfight in a New York subway car and the baby rolling out of the subway car and so they can go home and collect their welfare check. I see the same story about the man in a striped suit hitting a ball out of a park, and I see no outrage about what this man has done to this country. I'm amazed. I'm amazed that we have a traitor in the White House, as clear as I'm standing here, overtly handing the baton to Russia, to China, to every nation that wants to destroy us, and not a word from the American vermin in the media. Not one peep from the little boys and girls trained like brainwashed robots in the schools of journalism, which have been teaching them to hate the country, to hate the white man, to hate the supremacy of this nation, and they come out and they say nothing. And it falls upon me. One man, Michael Savage. You know anybody else in talk radio who said a word about it today? Oh, they were talking about Republicans dead and Cantor is good and Reed is bad. I understand that's all true. But the big picture is the big picture. Obama has decimated the space industry for the United States of America. He's decimated 10,000 jobs in NASA. Let's just take a point of view from jobs. Here is a liar from the gutters of Chicago put in by a gang that nobody even knows who the gang is. We only surmise the shadowy gang that controls the world. The shadowy gang that destroyed the economy to put this shyster into the White House. And now the man sits there and decimates the military, decimates the space program, decimates the American family. Let us go down the list together. I wrote the book, Trickle Up Poverty. A few hundred thousand of you bought it in hardcover. Hooray. Hooray. I can fill my gas tank and fill my guts. Hooray, hooray, hooray. You think that's why I wrote the book? Did I need to kill myself to write that book? Did I need to eat my guts out to write that book and put myself at further risk from the risk I'm already in? That the New World Order has recognized me for who I am? And they said, no, he will not talk freely. We'll smear him in England. We'll ban him in England. And God, hopefully that will ban him on the American media and we'll shut that guy up because he's the only one who knows what we're doing. At least he's the only one willing to say what we're doing. In such a forceful, clear way, we have to stop him. So let's smear him and let's make sure he can't go to the United Kingdom. Is that why I wrote Trickle Up Poverty? So that Obama could get away with this? The man should be impeached for this. If not for, let's say, at least three other crimes and misdemeanors, the man has decimated the space shuttle, given Russia the lead they've been after for 50 years, turned us into passengers on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. He's put us at the back of the bus. Do you understand what I just said to you? We'll now be riding on the back of the bus to the space station. He's put us at the back of the bus because he hates this country. There's no other explanation. The man hates America. He and his first lady hate America. In their guts, they hate America. And yet they abuse the office of the White House. They trash the White House. They trash the presidency. They abuse the taxpayer with their excessive trips. Their feasts at the White House. They tell you to eat carrot cake, to eat carrots, and they're feasting on fatty foods, disgusting cheeseburgers and French fries, and they tell you to eat carrots. And she gets away with it. He gets away with it. What are you afraid to say? What are the people afraid to say about Obama and why? What power does he have over you? You opened your big mouths in the media. You didn't shut your stinking mouths when Bush was president. You didn't shut your lousy left-wing pinko traps for 1 minute when Bush was in the White House. You didn't shut your yappers for a second. Every minute attacking him. And now not one word about Obama. You people with journalism degrees are the problem. you would have been very happy working for Joseph Stalin because you are no better than those who wrote Pravda or Izvestia. You wrote Pravda in this country for Obama now for 2 years now. Pravda, 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 the truth. The truth, Obama's truth, the Democrat socialist truth. The taxpayers of America are no good. The business people of America are greedy. Shall I go down the list? You know, there was a class of people in the Soviet Union called the kulaks. Who were the kulaks? They were farmers who sold their produce on the open market. They raised wheat, and they raised rye, and they raised oats. They raised apples, and they raised cabbages. And they sold their produce on the open market. And they were known as the kulaks. And they made a small living. Some of them made a good living, but most of them were small farmers. And Joseph Stalin declared them the enemy of the new Soviet Union. He said they are the greedy capitalists. They are why there is hunger in the Soviet Union. And so he nationalized or collectivized the Soviet farms. And he arrested or killed most of the farmers because they were the evil ones in the animal farm of the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And now we have a president who attacks the middle class in virtually every speech. He calls you greedy. He makes you embarrassed if you make a living and you buy a few things for yourself and your children and have the nerve and audacity to put some away for tomorrow. Because you see, the people he supports, the people he likes, are A, the greediest people that the world has ever seen, the hedge fund operators who are running like pirates with scarabs, running wild with no controls. They should have been reined in from day one. They should have been imprisoned and their assets seized for what they did to this country. But they're still doing it. I wrote about it in Trickle Up Poverty. They have names. They have organizations. The Managed Funds Association is their lobbying group. They're still giving Obama millions and millions of dollars. So he loves those people. And who else does he love? The non-taxpaying, non-working leech. The non-taxpaying, non-working leech. You know, I walked in San Francisco the other day. And I saw one homeless, filthy bum after another, scratching himself, rolling around in the grass, defecating behind bushes. I had no compassion for them. I have lived with these human parasites for so many years that I have no compassion. Why? Because the city spends hundreds of millions of dollars on these bums, and it goes right up their nose or right down their gullets. Either they drink themselves into the gutter or they snort themselves into the gutter, and you got people begging them to see what they can do for them next. Where did the hundreds of millions of dollars get us for the homeless services? Nothing. Again, liberalism is a mental disorder. Here in San Francisco, a parolee is out. The cops are looking for him in San Francisco because he was pimping a 14-year-old girl. The cops try to arrest him. He pulls out a gun and shoots the cops. And the black neighborhood, the Bayview Hunters Point District, goes ballistic. That's what the civil rights movement was for, to support gangbanging and drug dealers. This is the city, this is the country that we have inherited. And at the same time, on a macro level, Barack Hussein Obama, who ought to hang his head in shame, but the problem is he is not ashamed, he's very proud, because those who put him in power want him to do these things. They wanted us in the back of the bus. They wanted the Soviets to be the supreme leader in space. They wanted the Chinese currency to take over the world currency. Don't you understand what's going on in front of your eyes?
Savage.
You've got them saying now he ought to do it on his own. You got the communists, the naked communists, getting their dander up to actually expose themselves, saying he ought to just raise the debt limit. He doesn't need Congress. He really ought to act alone. Of course, that's an authoritarian dictatorship. But if you say that to them, they'll say, no, it isn't. You got to get those right-wingers out of the way. It's just acting in the interest of the people. The way who did, let's see, Mao Zedong, 30 million Chinese killed by Mao Zedong, the dictator. Joseph Stalin, 30 million killed, did it on his own. Adolf Hitler acted on his own. No Reichstag needed. I mean, they were there like the stooges in Congress. might be after Obama wins again. There'll be a fake Congress, as there is in Chavez's Venezuela. Right? Argentina, sorry. I always mix the two countries up. A is on the top and V is on the bottom. I don't know why I mix up Argentina and Venezuela. He is in Venezuela, isn't he? Yeah. But wherever he is, he's a dictator, and there's a fake Congress. So that's the model that MSNBC wants. Do it on your own, President Obama. Override that nasty Congress. We don't need checks and balances. We just need checks. We don't need balances. In fact, we don't want balances. We only want checks. In the midst of all of this madness, you do have to find your corners of sanity and peace. For me, it's water. I've always loved going out on the water. And I go out on my boat. It was windy all weekend, and I didn't think I'd get out because I don't really want to get a merit badge in stormy weather. You know what I'm saying? You got 16 states in heat, and here in California, Northern California, we're blessed. It's like 56, 57 degrees at night. You know, hits high 60s, maybe low 70s. We've just been enjoying phenomenally great weather after the heat wave of like early last week. Fog. Cool, you need a coat, the way I love it, right? So I don't go anywhere for that reason. What's the point of going anywhere? But I wanted to go out in the boat, but I don't want to go out in a 25, 30 knot wind. I'm really not in the mood for the merit badge and, you know, as I say, in stormy weather. So I'm waiting, waiting, waiting. So the weather breaks a little bit. So I call up my friend Mike, who's like, he's a captain. He delivers boats, great guy. And Mike, you want to go out? All right, I just delivered a boat. I'll come down in an hour because I didn't want to go out in even the mild wind alone. I can handle my 40-ton boat alone in decent weather, calm weather, and I do. But on a windy day, I really didn't want to come back with Teddy. I'm alone with Teddy. To try to dock with a poodle running around back and forth, he always thinks he's docking the boat with me. I mean, it's really funny to watch. The guy loves to hear the kid, the dog, a kid, guy. I don't know what he is anymore. It's like I'm a human being to me at this point. I'm going batty altogether. He's so attached to me. I'm so attached to the dog. I don't know whether he's a person or an animal, or I'm an animal or a dog half the time, or a person. We're like one in the same. We're bonded. So when I pull into a dock and I have to jump off the boat, he jumps too, and he tries to grab the lines and tie them up for me with his mouth. It's very cute, but very dangerous at the same time, because you got 40 tons of fiberglass, steel, stainless steel, teak, gasoline, diesel fuel, rather. You know, and oil and all sorts of things. You don't really want to be worried about a dog getting squashed between you and the dock. So I figured, all right, Michael, go out with me. So we go out, and it was absolutely incredible. And I was, again, one with nature, just a small 10-knot, 12-knot run down the bay. I like to watch the water, the movement of the water. I like to look at the landforms, which are amazing. You know what we have here in Northern California? We have an amazing geography. In that, you have pine-studded mountains that drop drastically right into the bay, and then you have 70 feet of water right offshore, 15 feet offshore, 10 feet offshore. You could be in 70 feet of water, because fundamentally, the entire Bay Area is on mountaintops, which, of course, if you're into geology, as I am, and botany, as I am, you realize that we're here as visitors on a very... We're visitors on this planet for a very, very brief interval, not only geologically... A very brief interval, but of course, in terms of our own life cycle. But you take a look at this, a bay like this, or wherever you may be, you look around, you see all this landform, you're on mountaintops. And look at what we, the ants, have accomplished in such a short period of time geologically as we have inhabited these mountaintops, I said to myself as we continued the boat through downtown Sausalito. And we better put that aside for a minute. The hordes of young men from Central America who are working every construction site in America directly as a result of the fact that young men in America are infantilized. All they want to do is party on, gel their hair and go out at night. They don't want to work. And this is the problem. Here we are. You're going to get mad at every alien, illegal alien, and say they're all no good? Look, let's be real about it. Let's stop the hogwash. The vegetables aren't picked unless they pick them. The electricity is not laid into your house unless they lay the electricity. The pipes are not laid down unless they lay down the pipes. You say, well, okay, if they weren't here, blah, 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 why the Republicans will do nothing. They're the ones who brought this on. Stop with your lies already. You people are deluded if you think that the Republicans are going to do anything about illegal aliens. They don't even care about it. So they're working here because there's jobs, that's all.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Christian terrorist. The greatest enemy is the enemy within. Is Norway's suspected murderer Breivik a Christian terrorist? Some would argue yes. I would include myself in that argument. Not to slam Christianity, but as a warning to those of you who think that it can't happen within your own ranks. It can and it did. It can and it did and it will happen again. Now listen to this.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
Now, I am a Goldwater conservative. I believe those are the truest words ever spoken in my lifetime, next to Eisenhower's Beware the Military-Industrial Complex. However, it doesn't mean that you have to go out and start slaughtering innocent people if you believe that extremism and the defense of liberty is no vice. It doesn't mean you go out and blow things up and blow up parliament buildings. It doesn't mean you go out and kill children. And what I'm trying to have you understand is you can be an extremist without being a murderer. You can be an extremist without being a terrorist. In fact, I want to educate you that you absolutely can be an extremist and not be a terrorist. You absolutely can be an extremist in what you do and work around the clock to save this nation without having to resort to what this lunatic did in Norway. That is the whole point of my show, which is not to now withdraw from the battle against multiculturalism, not to withdraw in your battle against socialism, not to withdraw in your battle against cultural and economic Marxism, but in fact to redouble on your efforts and fight them with everything in you without resorting to terrorism. Do not resort to terrorism. Do not become a murderer, but be an extremist. I'm trying to tell you, you can be an extremist without being a terrorist. And I think that these definitions become critical, especially in times of our like ours, where we have an extremist in the presidency. How would you define Barack Obama if not as an extremist? Barack Obama is an extremist. Why do I say he's an extremist? He has taken an extreme position of the far left, which is that you must raise taxes without cutting spending. You must raise taxes on the productive members of society, and you must not cut a dime of the benefits that are being sucked out of the system by the 80 million people a week who get checks from the U.S. Treasury. I think it was 80 million people a week get a check from the U.S. government. Who do you think's paying that check? Well, some put money in the system, that's true. But a good percentage of them are not getting that check because they earned it. They're getting it because I'm working. They're getting it because you're working. So any president who says they're going to get every dime, we're not cutting a penny, we're not raising the retirement age, we're not increasing the co-payment, nothing. We're not touching Medicare, Medicaid, and we're going to tax those who are the most productive members of society. I would say that by that definition, Obama is a radical extremist, not just an extremist. And so therefore, you can be an extremist without being a terrorist. 1-800-449-8255. California Governor Jerry Brown, a leftist extremist, by the way, nominates failed Obama pick Goodwin Liu to the state Supreme Court. He was rejected by the U.S. Senate, but this fanatic, this leftist fanatic, Gordon Liu, was picked by the extremist governor of California, Jerry Brown, who then put him on the state Supreme Court. See, I told you a politician can be an extremist without being a terrorist. And by definition, Jerry Brown is an extremist. Barack Obama is an extremist. You could argue George Bush was an extremist. Obama's clearly an extremist president. He knows that we're bankrupt. He knows he has to cut some of the so-called entitlement programs, but he won't do it. Instead, he wants to tax, tax, tax. And he wants to keep spending, spending, spending. By that definition, he is an extremist. Get it?
1-800-449-8255. Mike in New York on WOR. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Mike. You know, I want to take a viewpoint to marijuana. You know, it doesn't necessarily lead to other drugs. I've been smoking it for 45 years. Never.
And
had
you've and you've achieved a lot in your life, correct?
Yeah, I did. That's right. That's right. I
well, no, let's hear what you've achieved.
Okay, I work for the 10th largest advertising company in the country.
And what do you do for this advertising agency?
Media estimating. I check that commercials run on time for radio and TV.
All right. I'm sure you do your job well. But you don't think that marijuana has impaired you?
No, no way. I think alcohol is much...
Well, wait, hold it. We're not talking about alcohol. I'm not selling alcohol. See, this is the problem with you potheads. The minute anybody brings up the reality of the dangers of marijuana, you immediately jump to alcohol. I'm not saying that alcohol's desirable. You didn't hear me say that, did I?
No, but you drink all the time.
Hold on now. Just hold on now. You want to compare one to the other?
I do.
Okay. First of all, I'll ask you a question. Is marijuana fat-soluble or water-soluble?
I think it's fat-soluble.
All right. So what's the difference?
What's the difference is that people crash all the time, drunken drivers kill each other.
No. You see, you can't answer a question. That's what marijuana does to people. You cannot hold a rational argument. You're fit only for the advertising industry or something like skateboarding. I didn't ask you that. I asked you another question. What's the difference between fat solubility and water solubility? Would you like me to answer it, or you don't know the answer, or you do know the answer?
Fat soluble has a half-life in the bloodstream longer, so what? Big deal.
What do you mean, so what? You see, you're jumping over the facts. This is why your body is toxically polluted with many chemicals found in marijuana smoke, which you probably are aware of, but you don't want to admit. Mercury, cadmium, lead, chromium, nickel, arsenic. Shall I go down the list? Benzene, toluene, styrene, acetaldehyde, acetone. You can't argue that any of those compounds are healthful, can you?
It grows in the earth as a relaxant.
Now you're using the stupidest of all arguments, that is because it's natural, it's healthful?
Oh, well, you drink alcohol.
You're going back to something we're not talking about. You just said that because it's natural, it's healthful. Is that not what you're implying?
Look, you said that...
No, you look. You just said that because it's natural, it's good for you. Didn't you just say that it grows in the earth, it's good for you?
No, I said...
Did you or didn't you say that? I'm asking a simple question. Did you say that because marijuana grows in the earth, it's good for you? Didn't you say that?
It's one of nature's natural relaxants, okay?
Hold on. And because it's natural, it's healthful?
I didn't necessarily say it was helpful. You said it leads to other drugs.
Yes, it does. It is the gateway drug. You ask anybody who has studied the drug scourge in America, and everyone will tell you that marijuana is the gateway drug to every other drug.
It depends on the personality of the human being. A lot of people have addictions to food and fatsoes and all this and that. You know, you made a generalization, and it's not true. Einstein.
So you're wonderful. You're one of the few people who's thrived on marijuana and wound up with your sterling position working in an advertising agency. And did you ever think that if you were not a pothead, how far you may have gone? You might have been a creative director in an ad agency instead of a bean counter?
But Mike, Bill Buckley, the conservative with an IQ of 170, he took his boat out to over 4 miles into international waters, and he smoked the marijuana all the time. That was William Buckley, conservative.
So what? There are people who... There are anomalies all over the place. But why do you marijuana smokers get so defensive about pot? Why are you so addicted to it that you have to defend what's indefensible?
Because, Mike, you're putting down the people who use marijuana, but the alcohol... The people.
I didn't put down the people. I said the drug is dangerous, but you're making it personal.
Savage.
Of the space shuttle, America will continue the dream.
Roger, roll, Atlantis.
Houston now controlling the flight of Atlantis. The space shuttle spreads its wings one final time for the start of a sentimental journey into history. 24 seconds into the flight, roll program complete. Atlantis now heads down, wings level on the proper alignment for its 8.5-minute ride to orbit. 4.5 million pounds of hardware and humans taking aim on the International Space Station. 40 seconds into the flight, the three liquid fuel main engines throttling back to 72% of rated performance in the bucket, reducing stress on the shuttle as it goes transonic for the final time.
I'm at a loss for words. I almost have to take a break. I feel as though my country has been stolen from me by a communist, a common, loudmouth street agitator put in place by foreign enemies of this country. I don't know how to hold back what I really like to tell you.
other than to tell you what I'd really like to tell you. I feel like the famous picture of the Frenchman when the Nazis took over Paris, where he's wearing a suit and he looks up at the Arc de Triomphe and he's weeping as the Germans march down the Champs-Élysées through the arch. I feel as though the long march has been completed by the communists and this government. I feel that Obama was selected from early manhood, if not teenhood. I believe he was cultivated and trained. I believe he was put in place for this day. I believe this marks the end of our dominance, not only in space, but in the military arena as well, because if we do not control space in the very near future, it is the equivalent of not controlling air power in World War II or in any other war. If you don't control the air, you can't control the ground. And right now, we're no longer concerned about controlling air battles here in Earth's atmosphere. The new battles will take place in space. They'll be galactic. And he just destroyed our ability to have an edge over our growing enemies, the threats, of course, from China and Russia. He has just decimated us militarily, and without a sound coming from the media, other than one lone man who's been long enough to see this long arc and this long march. This long arc from Sputnik to the Marxist tyrant. This long arc from dominance militarily to being reduced to passengers on a Russian spacecraft without one peep, not one peep in the government media complex. Can you hear that Beowulf coming out on the air?
Oh, yeah.
You hear the foghorn, folks, in the background? Is it coming out, Beowulf?
Yeah.
You know what's going on outside my radio studio here in downtown San Francisco? There's a gorgeous cruise ship honking its horn because it's about to depart shortly, in about 5-6 minutes, out into the foggy bay. It's going to clear Alcatraz, then clear the gate. It's going to clear Point Lobos, then it's going to clear Point Bonita, the bonnet, which was named for a missionary's bonnet, and head out to sea God knows where, probably. Oh, it's summertime already. It means it's on an Alaska cruise. It's going to go up there to see Miss Alaska when it gets up there. And I always love looking at ships from the radio studio. It reminds me of the great adventures, the great nobility of ships. As you know, I'm an owner of a couple of little boats. And to me, a ship represents the nobility of mankind. If you ever look at a boat at sea, I don't care whether it's a small sailboat, a runabout, but a powerboat even above 30 feet, when you see it chugging along outside your window out in a bay or a city, doesn't it have its noble look, the bow cutting through the water? How noble it is to go out onto that bay when you realize how vast the sea is and you see it cutting through the water. It's almost like a puppy not knowing the danger it's in, running around in a room or running up to bigger dogs not knowing it could have its head shoot off. And to me, that was always the symbol of America's greatness and America's adventurousness. And today, in many ways, the captain of this nation, this brilliant captain of this nation, who, if only he was a true American, if only his loyalties were for America, could have been one of the great presidents of all time. Instead, unfortunately, he seems to be working for the other side in almost every way. Every day, I'm shocked at what he gets away with. He seems to be working for the other side. At least that's one man's opinion. Does it mean that America is over? No, I didn't say it's over, but it's over in many ways. Can we come back from this? I'll let you decide. Talk radio is still dominant in terms of the world of political ideas in this country. I did it on this show. It was done nowhere else. We kept hearing talk radio is this, talk radio is that. It's only for old people. Talk radio is dead. Cable news is king. Internet is king. I don't say they don't have a powerful influence. You got to be a fool not to say so. At this stage, though, you'd have to admit, no matter how much of a doubting Thomas you are, that Michael Savage has rescued talk radio from the gallows. Talk Radio Network, an independent syndicator. I work with the best team in talk radio. They know me. They're like my friends, all the guys in the back room. It's unbelievable to me. This is a family. This is a team. We are the Yankees of talk radio. If anyone out there has been doubting whether talk radio still is powerful, let me tell you something. It is more powerful today than it ever has been in my 16-year career. Much more powerful today. More listeners than ever. More influence than ever. That's if you're in a ring. If you're in the inner ring, you have an audience that needs you and listens to you. And if you make sense,
well, you're gonna make a lot of friends and a lot of unhappy people too. I wouldn't use the word enemies because we don't yet live in North Korea. Now, I want to go to nature for a minute. I'm a little all over the map because that's a better way to talk than it is in a straight logical fashion. Believe me, I could do the Aristotelian logic, mathematical, straight down the line, and not bat an eyelash because my mind is like a steel trap when I need it to be. But talk radio does not have to be Aristotelian, nor does it have to be two-dimensional or one-dimensional for me to make my point. Sometimes it could be four-dimensional or five-dimensional. And sometimes it could be any way I want it to be. So let me go now to another subject that's somewhat related. As you know, I'm a naturalist, and I enjoy watching nature. It gives me some of the calm I have, whether it be my dog, who gives me great calm. He's my best friend, obviously. I think he's a little sick from something. He's listless lately. I don't think it's serious, but he's not feeling well. Maybe it's because I'm not feeling well. And they pick up what you're feeling because they're mimics. At the end of the day, they're the greatest mimics on Earth. And we all know that. You eat, they eat. You go to the bathroom, they want to sit next to you. You go in a shower, they want to shower. You're happy, they're happy. You're talking to someone you like, they smile. You're upset and screaming and yelling, they get frightened and run away. So they're wonderful. We love them for that. And we know that. That's why we love our little friends, our little furry angels, I call them. So I observe animals, and one of the I like to watch birds lately. I've been getting more and more into bird life. I don't know what it is. And I have a house in the country up on a hill, and I've been watching for weeks now a peregrine falcon. At least I believe it's she's a peregrine falcon. Let's say for a moment it is. I don't know. I'm not an ornithologist. And she is protecting her nest from hawks, from predatory birds, other predatory birds who will keep circling her, trying to pick off an egg. Or maybe she has little birds in a nest, and she watches them like a hawk. She's in the hawk family. She circles and she swoops and she'll take on birds three times her size because those are her babies and her instincts kick in. And every day I come out with my binoculars and I stand up on the hill and I root for her. And I say, thank God she's there. Sometimes I'm afraid to look because I'm afraid she's going to be gone. And the other birds wore her out or killed her. And they killed her eggs and took it away. I mean, it's like a Disney movie to me, but much more deep than that. It's very survival of the fittest. And today I come up and there she is. She's up and she's circling. And you see the blackbirds coming in trying to take her. And she swoops down on them. They're twice her size. And she chases them away. And I say to myself, in addition to fighting off the predators who are trying to steal the eggs or her babies themselves, she has to go out and feed herself. Then she has to get food for her babies. And all of that is done. And that's how species survive. It's astounding to me. And then I see two welfare mothers on a subway car in New York, as fat as a house, fighting over a seat. And one of them forgets she has a baby in a stroller, her meal ticket, and the baby stroller rolls off the subway car out on the platform. Thank God the train was in a station. And they're pulling each other's hair out. And I say to myself that the human being is below that of an animal. The human being is less dignified than that of an animal. And I didn't want to come to this point in my analysis of humans. I've always had somewhat of a reluctance to go there. And then I go to another place I have right on the water, and I see seagulls. And what do I see this morning for the first time? I see the seagull mother bringing in fish for a hatchling. I couldn't believe it. A little seagull hatchling is there and crying for her mother, and she swoops in and brings up a little sardine. Swoops in the bay, gets the sardine, comes back on the roof of the neighbor's house, and goes from the mouth to the baby's mouth, and the baby eats. And she goes again, and the baby cries until the mother comes back, and the mother comes back with a little sardine or whatever, a little fishlet that is. And she feeds the baby. In addition to feeding the baby, she has to feed herself. She has to protect the baby from the elements and from other birds. And I say to myself, the animal is more noble than man. And then I look at this country. Once the most noble nation on earth, with the eagle as our symbol. What is our symbol under Obama, I ask myself. We are no longer the proud eagle. The man has torn the eagle's heart out.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Oh. Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
The debt ceiling talks more and more and more, more in circles and more attacks. The August 2nd deadline is drawing closer and closer. Is the default deadline truly August 2nd? Well, analysts say no, of course not. It's all hogwash. Pelosi says we're trying to save life on this planet as we know it today. Carney the Blarney House says the GOP is incredibly juvenile. Why? For representing the people. I guess that's juvenile to the communists. Let me take some calls. Las Vegas. Cal, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, I wanted to tell you, number one, Joseph Conrad has always been my favorite author, and that you read, you do affect people, because it's very interesting. I've been trying to write what I would have said had I not died at that moment to my children, and I'm entitling that, what I would have said had I not already
died. Oh, my God. So that's very interesting. Yeah, because in other words, before it's too late to get it out.
Exactly. And there's so many things that you have in your mind that are going to be unsaid. Even though I'm writing this, there'll be even more. And I just, you know, I really love your show, and I love the direction that you take me in, which is very often pearls. And that's the other thing. I collect pearls in my life. And when you said the pearl, I mean, just very, very much thinking. And the other thing I wanted to agree with you, I'm a sex therapist in Vegas, and I'm finding people very uninterested in this free sex. I'm finding young men who are becoming impotent because they just don't want to have sex, but rather than say it, their body says it for them. The boredom is creeping into sexuality. I think we're going to eventually, you know, 20, 30, 50 years, really go backwards.
So you agree with me that there will be a movement towards this Victorian so-called prudishness again. I think it'll be much faster than that time frame. My guess is it's going to be within 10 years, 10 to 12 years. There's going to be an entire reversal of this libertine, anything goes, let's do it in the road, you know. And the whole sluttiness is going to come to an end as well.
I absolutely see it. My grandson is 22 years old, and he called me the other night to say he's so happy to be sleeping alone. He said, I just feel so great. I'm alone, and I feel comfortable, and I love it. He says, I'm tired of these women. And it's just not him. I mean, my patients are saying the same kind of things.
But when you're a sex therapist, what is the primary thrust of the complaints people bring to you?
Well, primarily I work with couples who are just bored with each other and trying to keep some kind of flame alive. But I also am seeing young men, and this happened interestingly in the 70s, young men who were thinking they were impotent because their body was not responded to a woman coming on to them. And they really weren't. They just were not interested, and their body was reacting rather than their mind.
Well, I remember being taught back in Psych 101 at Queens College. I had a feminist professor, only we didn't know she was a feminist because they were not so self-designated in that time. So she said to us, the human being is the only animal on earth that thinks he is in heat 365 days a year. We didn't even know what she was talking about. And she said most animals go into a sexual heat during certain periods. Period. And the other times they're not interested at all. But man is so beaten to death with advertising and popular mythology that he thinks he's supposed to be ready at a moment's notice, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And if he isn't, there's something wrong with him.
Yeah, and it weighs very heavily, especially on young men and young women.
Right. And then the guy thinks he's gay. So then he goes down that road and finds out it's another false loop.
Exactly. I mean, the whole sexuality thing is so confusing and so demanding that it's not even fun anymore. And that's the problem. That's what's happening, and people are going away from it. They're really...
Well, but a lot of people then go into internet porn. Let's be clear. It's a booming business. They give up human beings, and they become a fantasist completely. I'll bet you see a lot of that, too.
We live in a depersonalized, alienated world. This whole, diversity... When we came to America, when our parents came to America, we merged and we became Americans. Now we're keeping our country fractionalized. You have to keep, you know, your separate entities, your separate diversities. And instead of merging and coming together, we're all separated and alienated. And that's what
But now that's a little separate, I think, from the concept of sexuality, which is your specialty. Of course, the sexual mores differ by culture as well. I would suspect, though, that most of the immigrants coming into America are far more sexually constrained than the population at large. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I really do. I think they're much.
For example, African cultures are extremely restricted sexually. They're shocked by what they see here. People don't even understand that we are at the bottom of the barrel in terms of sexual behavior. Worldwide, that the very thing we think we are, we're the exact opposite. All of this libertinism is, in fact, a degeneracy of the human spirit. It's not the elevation of the human spirit. And that's all I'm saying is that at some point there's going to be a gradual. Right now I can feel a gradualness moving in the other way, but there's got to be a limit to this, and I think we bottomed out a while ago.
Yeah, I see it. I see it happening. I really do. And maybe you're right. I think maybe it will be sooner than 30, 40 years.
Because so why are you writing a note to your children about what I wanted to say? Why do you suspect you should? Why do you feel you should do it now?
I was thinking exactly that. There's so much unsaid and undone, and then you're dead and it's too late. So why not put something in writing? I actually have a lot of written things that I've done for them, you know, over the years that I'm going to leave them. But this is the last thing. And
you're very interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny, one of the characters in my novel says, I forget where, it's about terrorism, by the way, my novel, at the end of the day. It's a major terrorist plot that's interrupted by my hero, strangely enough. And I don't want to give any more of it away. But in one of the scenes, I have one of the characters saying, for the things that he said that he wished he had not said, for the things he did that he wished he had not done, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I think that's human life. In other words, can we ever take back some of the things we said that we wish we hadn't said? Can we ever say the things that we wish we had said that we have not said? No, we can't do that.
That's the, you know, Omar Khayyam, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all the piety nor wit can move it back or cancel out a line of it. You can never.
No, I never heard that one. I mean, the closest I got to Omar Khayyam was Khalil Gibran.
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things that he said. You just cannot cancel anything, but you can give what you haven't given, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Oh, well, you mean because there's still time. You don't have to wait for the big deathbed scene.
No, and besides, I probably won't be able to say that much when I'm on the big deathbed.
I know, the big bed. The big bed. Oh, the big bed, horrible. Horrible. Well, let's not get too depressed right now, Cal. Thanks for calling the show.
Savage.
Play the clip.
One of the things that's come out of the House conference is this desire to stand firm and then stick the president with default, I think is one quote that came out of there, which is really incredibly juvenile, right? Is this the game that the idea here is who can be blamed for doing serious harm for our economy?
Come on, that's ridiculous. But identity theft is something you have to take seriously. What if someone stole your credit cards and tried to destroy your life? Don't be a victim. Call my advertiser, LifeLock, today. Call LifeLock now at 1-800-LOCK-485 and get 60 risk-free days just for Savage listeners. 1-800-LOCK-485. Call them now. Las Vegas, Kurt, what's your lifestyle question?
Thanks, Dr. Savage. I guess I'm just looking for some advice or to see what you do in my particular situation. Now, I'm 26 years old, and I've been married for pretty much 6 years now with my wife, and I've known her since we were 14, actually. Met in high school. Weren't high school sweethearts, just good friends. And as time gone by, you know, I joined the military, and I'm going to make it a career. I know that in my heart that I love it, and I'm trying to follow in my family's footsteps with it. And
beautiful.
Having said, too, I'm putting myself through college because I want to better myself inside that career and also have something I can do once.
Fantastic.
I get out after I serve.
Fantastic.
And as I'm getting older and like hitting it as hard as I can, my wife, she's just a stay-at-home wife, and she just mean, all I ask is please keep the house clean, you know, cook, do whatever you need. You just, you know, just support me at home because I'm going to do all the work. And just put yourself through school. I'll pay for it if we have to. I'll go any
route. But she doesn't want to go to school. She doesn't even want to do that.
No, like, honestly, we had the same exact classes this past semester, and it's a long story, but because of what she pulled, she decided to drop out, although I was ahead of her in the classes, and I was basically giving her the work, like, this is all you have to do.
Why did she drop out of school?
She just said she couldn't handle it, because, well, we have a son at home, and he's a special needs child, but she said she couldn't handle anything with having...
All right, so she's a little overwhelmed from the special needs situation. It as someone who had a brother, which I did, I don't know if you know, I had a brother who was born what they called brain damaged in those days. It seriously affects the other children. It affects the mother most profoundly, but it also affects the father profoundly. So you got to cut her some slack here. You know, she's filled with conflicts because both mother and father feel that they're somewhat at fault. And the guilt with regard to a special needs child is something that is never, ever discussed so far as I know. Yes, of course, you should focus on the child's needs, but the parents also have to be dealt with what they're feeling. I mean, you yourself probably have some problems with that, right?
Oh, I definitely do. And the thing is, this isn't our first child. Our first son, he actually passed away because of just a genetic malformation. We found out through negligence of the doctors when they did genetic testing.
Oh, God, what a mess.
We were both
wrong. What a sad, sad story. And you still have the heart to want to go into the military despite all of these terrible things that have happened to you?
Oh, yeah, I'm in the military. I've been in for about 4 years now, and I absolutely love it. I love doing my job every day.
Well, thank God you have a structure that is bigger than you, in which you can lose yourself. That is really the most important thing I have heard. But your wife is the problem now, correct?
Yes.
So what is it you'd like me to answer? I don't quite understand which part of this question I can help with at all.
Just with everything like weighing down on me, and just I just feel like I have to drag her along. It's not. I don't mean to be harsh about it. I know.
Oh no, be harsh because she's not listening to the show. Obviously, is that correct?
No, not at all.
Is she apolitical?
Is she political? No.
No, I'm saying so she is apolitical. She could care less about politics.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Does she know that you're very political?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Does she care about your politics? Does she find you to be too right-wing, too conservative or anything?
I find it bores her, you know, for the majority of it. And so I kind of...
Yeah, so you don't have that in common. You don't share a common... A political orientation, which is difficult. So what do you share other than the burden of the tragedies in your between the two of you? Do you share anything else?
We used to have more common interests when we were younger and when we were friends, and and we still seem to share some when we actually first got together, but as time goes by, it's just more and more of it has just dropped off, and it's, you know...
How are you doing financially?
Financially, I take care of everything, and I run the house as far as finances
go. No, I'm saying, do you have enough money as a member of the military to support your family right now?
Yes, I do. More than enough, actually. I've made some good...
You see, this is an interesting thing because, you know, military personnel are underpaid to begin with, but here you are saying I have more than enough. So you're not a greedy man. You're a very interesting person. You're a very good person. You want to give to the country, and you are giving to the country. You're a good father. You're a good husband. And you feel that your wife is somehow not a drag on you, but you don't know how to motivate her is what you're asking, what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't know what to do. I'm like kicking and screaming in the dark, and I've told her that. Like,
and I assume you're calling this radio program because you have no one else to turn to. Is that correct?
I mean, I've talked to family about it, but like somebody who's not family, not a close friend, just somebody on the outside, just, you know, unbiased opinion, who don't really know either of us and just can hear the situation.
Well, there's no way to kickstart people. You can't come up with some magic idea like bring home a, you know, Barbie doll for her and she's going to react to it. I'm using a metaphor, of course. The problem here is systemic between the two of you necessarily. But this woman has already, she's lost a child, right? You said you lost a child?
Yes, we have, and we're going to lose her.
Okay. Now you have a second child who is developmentally disabled, or what?
It's It's a whole slew. You probably know the terms. Miller-Deeker, Lissencephaly.
Oh, God, you're a poor God. It's terrible. Terrible suffering. You've got to understand your wife is suffering. She's in very deep pain, and I'm sure you do know that, correct?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
So you're afraid that if you don't do something and you don't intervene, she's going to drift further and further away from you and further away from an active life, and she's going to become a complete vegetable lost to the world, is what you fear.
Exactly.
Where is her mother in all of this?
You know, I want her to progress in her life. And be
No. Where is your wife's mother in all of this?
Where is she? Actually, another addition to the story is I'm actually slotted to go overseas in 4 days and for a year away from her, so she's with her mom in Florida.
Oh, my God. Is her mom at all helpful?
Oh, yeah, she's very helpful. She's a very, very wonderful woman, definitely.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do for your family only because you've touched me so deeply. It's not a big deal, but it's a token of my gratitude, and I'm sure for the people who are listening to this program across America, if you'll be so kind as to give us an address that is not on the air, but to my, my producer on the Savage Nation, I'm going to send you a gift of $500 for the July 4th weekend. It may not come until next week, but I just want to give you something personal for that, okay?
Wow, thank you. Oh, wow. I don't know what to say. Thank you so much.
Other than I'm sorry to hear you're going through such terribly difficult times, so I hope we don't get calls now of people who want money because I'm not going to give out any more money. I mean, it's just awful because as someone who's seen what a child who is handicapped does to everyone in the family without knowing, they don't do it. But what having a handicapped child or a developmentally disabled child, the effects upon the mother, the father, the other siblings is overwhelming. And people don't even understand it. And a father like this, who still has the strength to care enough to stay in the military and fight for his country, God bless him.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Dr. Phil's Beverly Hills Estate. $6.25 million self-help guru turned talk show host Dr. Phil McGraw and his wife Robin are selling their villa estate in Beverly Hills. What am I supposed to get me jealous about that? Since I'm skankled by it. Built in 1960, the Mediterranean-inspired home is situated almost half an acre and offers 6,900 square feet of living space. I bet it has a chef's kitchen. I bet you they serve Chardonnay wine. I bet you they eat fish. What do you mean they have a chef's kitchen? What's a chef's kitchen? Key rooms in the home include, don't you love these write-ups, these sappy write-ups? Key rooms in the home include a chef's kitchen with a breakfast bar. Ooh, a breakfast bar. We don't have that, Mildred. Theater-style family room, office, library. Ooh, it has a temperature-controlled wine storage area. You can buy them for $69 at Costco. And a formal living room, where you can have such luminaries over, as you can imagine, such as Sean Penn. How come Sean Penn's not visiting his hero, Chavez, in Cuba, where he's getting chemotherapy? The exterior feature of the home include a swimming pool and spa. How exciting. Archie Bunker has that. Covered porch, cabana, grill. Wow. Hey, it even has a private detached garage. Woo. That's really living it up. That's really living it up. It has closets. Look at that. That's like buying a car with a radio and heater. includes radio and heater. Separate here, his and her closets. And an intricate stone design motif in the bath. That's really worth getting up for in the morning. I mean, when you're stoned on a medical marijuana and the next morning you wake up and, you know, life has no meaning for you, just remember that you have a stone design motif in the bath. I love these chef kitchens that they advertise in these houses. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it if you're a chef. But I remember my mother, God rest her soul, we lived in an attached house in Queens, New York. You know, one of those, like a London, like an England house, like a brick house that's 20 feet wide and the lot's 100 feet deep. She had a stove, a four-burner electric stove in the kitchen. What she could cook on that four-burner electric stove, she always had four gourmet meals going at any one. When I say gourmet, I don't mean fancy. I don't mean drizzled with strawberry juice. I mean real meals, and they would be in the refrigerator waiting for you to come home from, like, college. And I'd say, Ma, what's to eat? She says, well, we have this. We have that. Like four different restaurant-sized meals, all on four electric burners. She didn't need a chef's kitchen. We didn't have a breakfast bar. Unbelievable. I have a picture of her in my old book. I found a copy of, where is it? The Enemy Within. I found pictures of it that I put in there. That's actually, in a way, what am I writing for anymore? I should have stopped with The Enemy Within. I showed family pictures, the brother, the mother, the father, the dog. I showed me as a young man with the weightlifting. How many books do I have to write until it's over? When does God say you can take your hands off the wheel? Do I have to die to stop writing books and doing radio? I got to ask myself a question. If I were a normal person, I would have retired 15 years ago. Why am I doing this? A, because the country's in trouble, and B, I think I can have an impact. C, because there's a degree of ego involved, and I want to prove that I can do it. I've been thinking about that. How much is ego driven of all of us? How much? What drive is this from a work ethic I have? I ask myself every day to keep going and going and going when really I'm asking you. I mean, why am I doing this? Should I keep doing this? Now the lights will go on. Of course you want me to do it. You wanted Jesus on the cross also with the spikes in the hands and the feet. Of course you want me to keep crucifying myself on the air every day. I need a vacation. Maybe I should go to that boat in Nice and relax, kick my feet up, and just drink for 7 or 10 days. 1-800-449-8255, Michael Savage. Dr. Phil's Beverly Hills Estate. What kind of doctor is that guy? What does he do on the television? I never watched the Does anyone know what he does? Dr. Phil. How could you believe in a guy called Dr. Phil? If you go to a real doctor, let's say you like your heart, you have pains in your chest, would you? I don't like knowing a doctor's first name. I want to call them doctor. That was another thing I never liked. Like when I was in graduate school, when you thought you were familiar as a graduate student with the professor, where you could call him by the first name like Leonard. But I was always uncomfortable. I was the kind of guy who always used to call him doctor, Dr. Blatstein, because it was more formal. I didn't want to call him Leonard. I didn't want to know. I mean, Leonard was killing the mice anyway. You know, it was like Lenny and the mice in the Grapes of Wrath. But Dr. Leonard Platskin. I'd rather call him Dr. Platskin instead of Leonard. He died of brain cancer. Remember I told you about the guy who said you have to kill the rats or you're going to lose your fellowship, and he knew I had no money? I said, well, I guess I lost my fellowship. I'm not killing the rats. He said, get out of here. He threw me out of the laboratory. I had nothing. And that's how I went into another field of botany, because I didn't have to kill animals. It's not that I loved rats. I didn't want to kill them. He said, it's two different things. You don't have to love rats to not want to pith their brains and see them die in your hand. You know who enjoyed doing it? And I'm sorry to say this. This doctor, he died soon thereafter of brain cancer from all his experiments and his the weird chemicals he was using. He was a pharmacologist. I know his name. I can't mention his name because the widow will probably give me a sue. I didn't like him. He was a mean son of a gun throwing me out like that. So, kill the rats or you're going to lose your fellowship. I said, okay, I lost my fellowship. I had nothing, zero. And I wound up in ethnobotany because of that. So, you know who we found who did the job, who loved... And she was a dwarf. She was a very nice dwarf, by the way, and I got along with her very well till they fired me. I don't know. I didn't keep in touch with her. But it was something so crazy in that laboratory. She would hold a little lab rat in her hand and stroke it and talk to it. You're like, hello, Dory. How are you today, Dory? And she'd soothe it, and then from the behind, she'd come up with like a Nazi in the back of the neck and pith it. You had to experiment to see what was like the organs, what they looked like after they gave them Jell-O, They put one set of rats on Jell-O, another set of rats on, rat feed, and another set of rats on, a diet that I grew up on. And whichever one died first, they would definitely sell that diet to the American people. Okay, Michelle in New York on WOR. What's on your mind, Michelle? Go ahead, please.
Savage, it's an honor to speak to you. I enjoy listening to you every evening.
Even when I get distracted today and talk about little stories like that, you like it? You like the storytelling?
I want to tell you, I was impressed with the story of your mother's cooking, because my mother, being a German lady, unfortunately now deceased, cooked the most wonderful meals in a very tiny, tiny kitchen in Munich, Germany. And I just say it's the chef that makes the kitchen and not the kitchen that makes the chef.
I have the copy of from a book I wrote years ago called The Enemy Within. In the middle of it, on the left side, with Mom in her kitchen, Queens, New York, 1980s, and she's holding you could see the stove. Boy, did I look good. Look what happens to a man in a few years. And there's a big thing of soup she made and everything else, all on a little four-burner stove. There's my father, long dead, with my dog, Tippy, who bit me down to the bone. Tippy the dog bit down my...
Oh, my goodness. I come originally from Manhattan, and that's what our dog's name was, Tippy.
Maybe it was a popular name in those days, like Muhammad is in London today. You know, like Muhammad's the most popular name for young boys in London. Maybe Tippy was a popular dog's name then.
That's coincidental, huh?
You want to hear something funny? Like, I started talking about Tippy the dog when I went on radio, starting in the beginning, right? So I was a local host in 1994, became national in the year 2000, and I would tell family stories. I saw a replay of The Sopranos recently, and there was a flashback to when Tony Soprano was a kid. He had a dog named Tippy. They probably got it from my show, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I wonder how many of my ideas have wound up in TV shows and stuff like that.
I'm sure many.
Here I am with my son who kicked off the Paul Revere Society and is now... See, I was showing the Compassionate Conservative... Look at this. One of many Compassionate Conservative conventions long before the Republicans used it. I was Glenn Beck long before Glenn Beck was in recovery. Before he even, you know, kicked the bottle. I mean, I was doing big events. Before the Tea Party has ever had tea, I was doing big events. Which is good. It's all a sequence. I don't need the credit for it. I know what I've done. And here I am years later. So what was your favorite dish as a young German girl?
Well, my mother used to make for my birthday strawberry shortcake homemade every year.
See, I don't eat sweets. And I don't eat sweets. I mean, I have a good friend who's a pastry chef. And he cooks them for other people, but he doesn't eat much of them himself. So I'm talking about regular food, not pastry. What was your favorite mother's meal?
Delicious roast pork made with beer, onions, and carrots.
How about Spretzel? What's that stuff? I go to a German restaurant from time to time.
Like, it's like a homemade pasta.
What's it? No, Spretzel. What's it called? Spretzel or Spreckel?
Spetzel, it's called.
Schmeckel?
Spetzel with an S. It's like Sam. Spetzel.
It sounds like my uncle used to call him a Schmeckel.
But she could whip up fabulous dishes of all ethnicities. Really.
No, seriously, what is that grain? What is Schmeckel? I mean, speckle. What is it?
Made from flour and water and some salt.
Oh, you mean you roll up like little, and you fry it?
No, it's boiled in water.
Oh, it's boiled, because I know it doesn't, you know, like stick in your gut. It's very good.
It is. It's delicious.
My mother made a dumpling. You know, it's funny. I love certain Chinese foods. Like, everyone loves pot stickers, right? Everybody does. But it runs throughout all cultures, the equivalent of the pot sticker. The Eastern European version of the pot sticker was two pieces of dough that she rolled by hand with the rolling pin, right? And she would stuff it with potato and onion and then put the dough over it. And she'd boil it in water. It was the most delicious thing in my life.
Okay.
I have the recipe somewhere. I never made it. I like to try making it myself.
Germans also make something similar with a potato dumpling. It's called a Kartoffelknödel.
A Kartoffelknödel? It looks like what, Bill Clinton's ears?
I want to tell you something else in reference to the kitchen. I'm trying to sell my home for over a year, and the people don't want to buy it because I don't have the granite countertops.
Oh, yeah, and you need the lighting and the granite countertops, sure, so they can not cook in it.
Kitchen, so they don't want it. They don't cook.
Isn't that? Well, no, you have to renovate the kitchen. They don't even want to bar. That's a big job, by the way. So I want to go back to one German dish that I like. I like, do you like goulash?
Yes.
Now, that's not German. Goulash is that's not a
Hungarian.
German dish, is it? It's Hungarian.
Yes.
Yeah, Hungarians are like a weird thing. Hungary, Huns. Isn't it true about the Huns invaded that part of Europe and they're descendants of the Huns?
I believe so, but I can't.
Yeah. Well, all right. They knew a little bit about food and meat from all of the years of the Marco Polo. And all right. Thanks for the call.
Savage.
So I say to my Republican colleagues here in the Senate, do the right thing. Put the interests of the country ahead of the Tea Party extremists. They're the ones driving that. They're all in town. That's what all the news said. They came. They've made all these demands. The people that we all represent want us to come together in a bipartisan method. Compromise is not a bad word. So it's time for us to act together. And we hold our arms out to my Republican colleagues to visit with me, talk to me how we can strengthen my legislation. It's really time that they legislate. As we know, they're having trouble doing that. They've changed this so many times, it should be fairly easy to get the votes now. They've basically given the right wing even more than what they had before.
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199, 800-255-4199, or go to americaisrising.com, 800-255-4199, americaisrising.com. Talk radio is not a dying medium. It is stronger than ever. It is stronger than it's ever been before. In my 16 years in radio, Mark Masters, who has syndicated me for over 9 years now, and we're going to be, as Harry Truman said, give him you-know-what for the next couple of years. That's our job. Our job is to be watchdogs, not to be lapdogs, Mark. And I want to thank you for giving me total and absolute freedom to do so. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that. That's would have been the end of it for me. I've had total freedom. I need total freedom to function. And Mark, I want to thank you again. I'm glad we're going to be working together. And I know the American people, who particularly the millions and millions of people who listen to this show, are going to breathe a sigh of relief that we have this year to look forward to together. It's had its ups and downs. But right now, we have seen the talk radio and the Savage Nation are responsible for the mighty blow that is being struck against socialism in America. And I believe this will grow when it forces the Democrats off the political landscape for having introduced Democrat socialism and worse to the United States of America. Okay, moving on.
The United States will pay its bills and we will honor the full faith and credit of our country. I salute President Obama for putting forth a grand bargain. This is about the future in a very important way that reduces the deficit well into the future, and we should still strive for that or come as close to it as we possibly can. So I would hope that everyone is spending their energy on how we get that done rather than who's not going to be paid.
Yes, the circus continues with the chief clown in the center ring and the Democrat clowns around him. You know, there was a great article in the Washington Times by Dr. Milton Wolf called German Miracle Barack Obama Doesn't See, and it's an amazingly important article. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. You should read the whole thing. I linked it up on michaelsavage.com. I'm going to read you one paragraph. The devastation caused by Obamanomics is now undeniable. According to Investors Business Daily, 2 million net private sector jobs have been lost. Unemployment has increased by 1.5 percentage points. Long-term unemployment is the worst ever on record. The dollar is 12% weaker. The number of Americans on food stamps has increased by 37%. The misery index, unemployment plus inflation, has increased by 62%. And the national debt has exploded by an alarming 40%. Mr. Obama is on pace to saddle America with more job-killing debt than all the first 43 presidents combined. Now, they then give you a solution. It doesn't have to be this way. Mr. Obama, they said, is trapped in the mistaken belief that America's problems can only be solved by growing our government even larger. When all of you have is a hammer, when all you have is a hammer, they write, everything looks like a nail. And they then talk about what happened in Germany after World War II and how they saved their economy. You see, after World War II, a defeated and devastated Germany was under American occupation, and it was controlled by Keynesian economists along the lines of those advising our imposter president. And that Keynesian economic viewpoint included the American price control czar himself, John Kenneth Galbraith. The American overlords of Germany, as well as Germany's new Social Democratic Party, favored maintaining, listen to this, they favored maintaining the Nazi government's top-down government-directed economy with its price and wage controls and restrictive regulations, which unsurprisingly created economic stagnation and crippling shortages of basic goods. Let me pause right here. So right after World War II, Germany's crippled. They say, you know what, we're going to keep the Nazi system of government where we have price controls, restrictive regulations. And what happened was they had economic stagnation and crippling shortages of basic goods. And then one bold German economist who understood the power of freedom dared to disagree. In a swift move on June 20th, 1948, a Sunday when everyone was away, economic director Ludwig Erhard freed the German market and the people and he abolished most of the restrictive price controls and other burdensome government regulations while he simultaneously solidified monetary policy with the introduction of the Deutschmark. The American Keynesians and German socialists were aghast, but Erhard was quickly proven right. What happened? Germany's economy responded with a roar heard round the world. Within weeks, businesses sparked back to life, and crippling shortages were eliminated. Within a year, the war-torn Western zones united to become Western Germany, which quickly and overwhelmingly outpaced the Soviet-controlled Eastern Germany. Within 10 years, West Germany's economic doubled, leaving behind West Germany's economy doubled, leaving behind Allied winners of the war, France and England. Despite the Marshall Plan, within a half century, the Berlin Wall crumbled, and with it, the Soviets' evil empire. This is the story of the German economic miracle. What does this have to do with your idiot in the White House? What does this have to do with morons like Nancy Pelosi? What does this have to do with big government nightmare psychotics like the Democrat Party? Mr. Obama has turned our Great Recession into the Obama Depression with his own, now old, tired and discredited big government schemes. Meanwhile, Obama cannot see the obvious lessons of the German miracle. Unleash the free market, unshackle entrepreneurs and workers from big government controls, and we, the free people of the United States, can rescue our economy and create our own 21st century American miracle. Again, Dr. Milton Wolf, The Washington Times, German Miracle, Barack Obama Does Not See. I linked it up on michaelsavage.com. If you care to comment on this, give me a call at 1-800-449-8255. It's astounding. It is astounding to see that the basics are not understood by this college group, these college stooges who are running America, along with the corrupt Democrat stooges, and that is why this country is in such trouble. A generic Republican running against Obama would beat him by 8 percentage points.
Savage.